You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. If you're interested in listening at home on your PC, iPhone, or BlackBerry, where this station streams live on the internet, please visit www.wsps.sps.edu or visit my website at radioghost.com for the link. When I was a boy, I had a great deal of trouble falling asleep. I'd lay in bed in a growing turbulence, and against every design and desire placed upon me by myself and my parents, I only became ever more exercised and alert. I did not have the traditional child's fear of monsters. Their furry closet-lurking banality would have been a relief. For what I was up against was that thing the furry-friendly monster stood in for. I simply lay in a kind of shining fear as the universe expanded in my chest to an infinite width before suddenly compressing down into an atomic particle. In and out the universe pulsed, and I shuddered and jittered my felt witness, my calves and shoulders and back soon cramping from the hyperkinetic small flings of my exertion. I would now assign this nighttime fit, this emotional distress, to my young, unfinished person's inability to cope with angst, as, at the basic root, what I feared as a boy was death itself, as evoked in the conflicted awareness of infinite space and nothingness. But I did not know this then. I only felt the vertiginous misery of my soul's probing the cold, vast ocean of aloneness and separation, as it sank into a hot point of extinction. Enormousness and nothingness were the two sides of death's coin. I don't know how or when my little trick, my soothing solution to this problem came into being, but it's a device I still utilize, and I refer to it in my skull with a phrase as the boy in the bed and the boy in the tree. So when I find myself beset in the darkness by my angst, I might say, well, it's time for a little boy in the bed, boy in the tree. While originally this trick entailed a bit of forced imagination, I would literally shout it into my brain, the boy is in the tree, the boy is in the tree. Now I can conjure the experience quite readily. There was, up the street from my childhood home, a very joyous and powerful little boy who liked to climb trees. His name was Sam James. He was always dressed in orange shirts and red shorts, and always smiling and giggling to himself, always quite dirty and messy. A little like Peter Pan, I thought, in some recusement from the rules that hung heavy over the rest of us, in the wild, full freedom of his ways. What he especially seemed to lack was an awareness of that void that so overwhelmed me. I was attracted then to his unbothered presence, as though his grounded freedom could serve as my relief. I longed to be Sam James's friend, but to no avail. No matter my effort, I could never quite catch up to him. He was always too high up the tree, too far down the street, or just too fast for me. Daily, I found myself at his heels, chasing after his disappearing form, calling out, "Wait up! Wait up!" But one evening, while struggling in my bed, I managed to discover a gentle little eddy of peace just to one side of my discontent, and into this space a completed daydream suddenly flowed. In my imagination, I finally caught up to Sam James. He greeted me well with a smile. To seal our friendship, he pointed to a large oak tree in my yard, which we immediately began to ascend. In the dream, I noticed that the moment I touched the tree, my clothing became like Sam James's. I was barefoot, in red shorts and an orange shirt. As I began to climb, I realized how light and easy a thing it was to live. There was nothing but climbing trees. The only difficulty was a pleasure, and that was the challenge of finding the next branch to grab hold of, and then finding a place to put one's foot or toes. The more I concentrated on the tree, the more like Sam James I became. My fingers sought out the small divots in the bark as my toes purchased at the nubs of freshly grown shoots. With more pleasant effort, I found that I could place my feet and my fingertips into and upon the rough tread of the bark in any place I liked, and in the most wonderful and magical and deliberate and slow way, I could roam and swirl around the tree like a squirrel. After this discovery, I realized that I was, after all, Sam James, and that my new friend, Sherwin, the little boy who'd been climbing with me, had snuck down over the branches and back into his bedroom window. As Sam James, I was also aware of how difficult it was for him to sleep, and how comforting it would be for him if I crawled down over the branches to stand lookout, to supervise his sleep, as it were, from my perch in the moonlit branches, to offer him the warmth of the essence of my deeply peaceful relation with the world. And once this very full idea of my being Sam James took root, and I had assumed my sentry post in the branches, I once again reappeared in my bed and became Sherwin's Leaves. In the transition, I understood that Sam James remained outside in the tree. In the safe halo of his protection, I paddled towards sleep. Sam James would keep me company. Shortly after this established, I became Sam James in the tree again, where I once more flowed with the beauty of being the watchman, the caretaker. This was my gift to Sherwin, a gift of peace and love and shared being. And after acknowledging this perfect empathy, I flew back into bed as myself. For the few moments before I finally and fully went down, a kind of shuttling of being back and forth took place. I was Sam James in the tree, watching the boy in the bed, and then I was myself in bed, being watched over by Sam James. I received increasing measures of peace and comfort from each of these perspectives. The shuttling grew in speed, back and forth, until a strange, smooth, creaming together revealed that both the boy in the tree and the boy in the bed were one, and I fell asleep somewhere in the blurring, gentle vortex, both boys and neither. I suppose I say this now because, as I leaned over the collapsed woman in the hall outside Arthur Berylbane's apartment, as my fingers reached down to check her pulse, I was overcome by an eruptive shift in perspective. The moment my fingers touched her soft skin, I was no longer myself kneeling over her, but rather, I was her, collapsed in the hall, feeling two cold fingers pressing my neck. With some psychological effort, I jumped back into my own being, just long enough to note my confusion. What was happening here? But before I could process this place trading, I went caroming back into her being. For all these long years, Sam James had been my deepest inner companion. I'd assumed, without a second thought, that he would be there with me until my end, that my strangely concocted scheme of self-nurturing would always be delivered through his grace. But now, without permission, without foreknowledge, and for no reason I could say, he was being sent away, and a new partner had been foisted upon me. Someone real this time. Someone right here. There were tears in my eyes, and then tears in hers, as, for a last time, I found myself stumbling down the sidewalks of my youth, chasing after Sam James, calling, wait up, to his orange shirt and red shorts, as his bare wild feet got smaller and smaller, as for a last time, I tried to catch him before he blurred into the missing distance.
In the morning without a sound.
With a sudden burst, we both flew awake. The woman in the hall, whose blue eyes were now drilling mine with curiosity, exhaled a long, held breath. Her eyes fluttered closed, and after a moment she swallowed softly and turned on her side and returned, I understood, to sleep. I lifted her into my arms and brought her into the apartment. I made murmur to the effect that we would get her soon into a warm bed. But after 10 minutes of kicking through every last door I could find, I finally had to admit that Arthur Battlebane did not have a bedroom, just a series of reading rooms and studies, each with a small closet. I had entered each of these rooms several times, disbelieving that any residence could go without what seemed at that moment its most vital room. No bed anywhere. I set the woman down on a couch, but could find no blanket. I took a candle from the kitchen, sat down on a chair opposite the sleeping woman, and noticed right away that in her left hand she held a sheet of tightly folded paper. I took the note, opened it, and read, "Dear Sir, I hope you are finding your first hours under new management as pleasant as I am sure to be finding mine. If you are reading this note, then you have met my twin sister, Tristram. As I, and now you, enjoy the company of our twin sister, I have asked Tristram to visit you this evening, and for the next little while. I have made the special request that she not be intoxicated, but she is not altogether reliable, and must sometimes self-medicate for a condition she and I both share. It may be a shock to your bachelor system to have her there. Let this be the first of many small wakings up into the world of other people, and into this life you have agreed, at least temporarily, to live. Obviously, as she is your sister now, there is nothing to enjoy but her companionship. She is quite bright, and very funny, and empathetic, and makes for an excellent friend and sister. She does occasionally make an unusual request or two, but what can really trouble a man who's agreed to switch out his life? By the way, I smoke, thus you do. You may or may not find this an onerous part of the masquerade, but unless you intend on a bad performance, my cigarettes, which arrive by mail every 2 weeks, are kept in a box on the desk. I smoke 11 cigarettes a day. I get drunk twice a week, Friday night and Monday night. Friday, always at the alley. Monday, starting at the restaurant on 7th Street, and then continuing at the alley. I have written you a handful of notes, similar to this one, with instructions, information, etc. You will stumble upon them as you live my life. You will not discover them if you do not live my life. Tristram will provide you with guidance here and there as she sees fit, as you obviously have not had any intimate acquaintance with my way or person. My bank information is in the top drawer of my desk in the main study. All appropriate arrangement as to documentation will be found there. You will quickly learn that I do not have a bed. I do not sleep much, and when I do, I am never supine. I have Corinne disease, and my vertebrae are disintegrating. My sister suffers from this too. I thus sleep at my desk, or semi-flat on one of the wider sofas. You will shortly find a note about my keys and their use, and especially the use of the largest key. I say this to you seriously. Have a good life. Enjoy it. I will not be in communication with you into the future. Kind regards. P.S. Miss Strigil was to be my last play. I am now under contract to write a book, which means, of course, that you are. The first draft is due in 3 months. Its title, of course, is Streamlines of the Futurist. I think you know already how it starts. I watched over Tristram for some time. There was something perplexingly unfixed in her face, as though I could not quite get a handle on its lines. Did she have a wide or narrow nose? Her cheeks, it seemed to me, were set high, and then low, and then were nearly invisible. When I closed my eyes, I could not picture her, only the darkness of her hair, the white frill of her dress, and my sense that though in her middle age, she was quite pretty. And as I watched her sleeping, her face seemed to alter and expand and shift, not with ugliness, but tidally, as though to a liquid kind of rule. As the night entered its pearl, I found myself restless. I wandered about the large rooms and finally noted out the great window, a shadowy heap of furniture. I pulled the window wide and strolled out onto a quite large balcony, where a scattering of iron furniture stood. I returned briefly to the main study, opened the dark wooden box on the desk, and withdrew several cigarettes. Starting up a new habit was something I was used to from the stage, like getting a special haircut that suited a character, or wearing special clothing. I sat on a leaden chair, overlooking the treetops of the Windsor Parks, and lit my first ever cigarette. Because of the rather decimated state of my lungs, I had never before smoked. I puffed it like a boy, not sucking the smoke down into my lungs, but just tentatively poking my breath at the filter and trying to keep the thing from extinguishing. Every once in a while, in the blue night, a dog barked. Every once in a while, a man shouted. Every once in a while, something seemed to fall. I wondered if such things occurred at the same rate during the day, only that one could not hear them for all the hustle and bustle of everything else. I tossed my first finished cigarette off the balcony and watched it fall before sitting back and smoking another. I did better with the second, but my mouth was quickly dried and ashen, and I fetched the bottle of wine for its rinse and pleasant other contributions. The sun rose upon me in this way, in a stupor of wine, cigarettes, and sleeplessness. I sat in the building's shadows, as bright orange and yellow spheres formed on the taller buildings before me. The air was cold, and I seemed only to be reminded of my shivering body by the bright, heartless splashes of light on the faraway buildings. My bones were splintery and hard-feeling, while my body felt badly dreamt and slung in a kind of mossy hammock. A wind tested my forehead, and the balcony doors opened to a ghost touch. Without a sound, as the sun threw a handful of goldenrod at my shadowy balcony, tea set in hand, Tristram stepped out to greet me. She said nothing, but merely smiled. Her eyes were sparkling, and her arching smile contained a child's giddy happiness, as though we two had quite the best secret, as though to say, "The game's afoot, and I'm quite eager to play." I smiled and nodded, trying myself not to seem too overly pleased to be a part of so unadulterated a charade. She set the tray down and dribbled rosy tea into my cup. She took a cigarette from the box I'd brought out from the desk, placed it carefully in the side of her lips, lit it, and sat down. I noticed with this that a strange feature of her face was a slightly off-center mouth. It was as though the right side of her face was slack with palsy. From a small pocket in her dress, she pulled a pre-written note, which she pushed across the table toward me. I lifted and read this. "No talking for today, if that's all right," the note read. She extended a pad of paper and a pencil and gestured for my response. I wrote, "My lips are sealed." We two sat in our silences, as though they were separately formed, as the world around us grew into its life, standing up into business, into the clatter of traffic, the rumbling shuffle of pedestrians, the windy, white noise of the human machine. After a time she stood, leaned toward me, kissed my cheek, and presented her final note of the day. "Good morning, brother," it read.
"I don't have any more problems. All of my worries are gone. Beautiful angels appear at my side, and corporate sponsors will act as my guides. Agents and analysts take me inside the other side of this life. Beautiful people are walking, and beautiful people are we. Bright as the sunlight at noon every day. The people in nightclubs, they all turn away. But when it's over, we're returning to the other side of this life. I'm in a church of your hairdo, and I'm in a shrine of your legs. I promise to love and to worship each day.
doctor, I'm back for a visit. The symptoms are worse than before. Although it's spelled wrong, my name's up in lights. I feel so good, but you say it's all right. I've been the price if you'll help me to fight the other side of this life. The other side of this life.
I spent most of that first day wandering back and forth between the balcony and the apartment. I was content, but at a loss. Curious mix of not knowing what next to do while not minding. I was definitely unslept and a little drunk and woozy from the smoke, but I was not ill, and I was not faint. It was a pleasant kind of bath, and as long as I could stay warm, I felt I might go on like this for quite some time. At noon, Tristram brought me a sandwich and a novel, both of them quite similarly sized. Her playfulness manifested here as she brought me the book on a plate, and took the sandwich down from the bookshelves and handed it to me as though I might find its plot interesting. I ate the sandwich and read for an hour or so until she returned and tapped my shoulder. She pointed at the main study. We both went in. There was a typewriter on the table and a stack of blank paper. Tristram set the first page up and typed for a moment, then gestured that I sit. I did so and read what she'd written. Streamlines of the Futurist. By Show and Sleeves. Chapter 1. There seemed to be some lack of continuity in the fact that I was, according to the game, involving myself into the life of Arthur Battlebane, while yet here was this glaring reference to a person who, I supposed, I was no longer obligated to call myself. I did not fight this complexity. I would leave that for tomorrow, or whenever Tristram lifted the ban on conversation. She gestured that I return the typewriter carriage. Without thinking, I wrote the only line from the book that I could remember. Time comes from the future. Tristram clapped lightly and then shook my chair, indicating that my book writing had come to an end for the day. I desperately wished to joke. Ah, the life of a writer! And the words were nearly at my lips when I saw her raise a finger to her own mouth. She took my hand and led me back into the main living area. She patted the large reading chair, and I sat down. Before me was the dark pile of my Hanalikan, the special Stalwart's outfit I'd recently acquired and only briefly used. Tristram handed me a folded page and went into the kitchen. I opened this note and read, "Dear Sir, Tristram will have hopefully found your Hanalikan and set it out for you. I hope you were able to sleep. I hope your first stab at writing was promising. The only guidance I can give you about the book is that you do indeed write it. Therefore, whatever it is you write has already been written, and the book has already gone on to satisfy its need. Understandably, you will feel at a loss. I can only tell you that you should not try to write the book. Let it come out as it does, in the way it wants. You are not really the author. You are just leading something from the world, through yourself, and back out into the world. Tristram will eventually share some of my idiosyncrasies with you, as it will become important that you do my part with ever more correct approximation. But, strange as it may seem at this initial moment, it is not so important that you discover who I am. It is, paradoxically, important for you to find out who you are. To this end, I suggest that you don your special dark outfit and come to the theatre this evening. I shall leave the rear doors a little after 10. I should say that it will be best if you do not judge my imitation of you. Simply observe it. Observe Show and Sleeves. Observe the imitation without thinking, that's not me, that's not how I do it. Certainly, I will get some things wrong, but it is the essence of the thing that will be most important, the root, the fundament. I believe I quite strongly offer your essence. I will expect your presence, but I will not look for you or speak to you. For your ease, my front door will not be locked, and for this evening and for the next few weeks, despite my problematic back, I will take to your bed and sleep as you do. I will not warn you off this experience much, but I will say that I have never known anyone to experience themselves well. it is to be expected that the Sherwin sleeves you see tonight will not be someone that you like. In fact, quite the opposite. Been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. For more information on the show and the songs, please visit my website at radioghost.com. I'm Sherwin Sleeves. Tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. for more stories and music. Thank you, my friends.